Today on The Power of Others, it's a conversation with Leo Battari, author of Peernovation. It's season 2020, episode 31. Greetings and welcome inside the Yellow Studio. My name is Randy Cantrell. I am your host here. The website is thepowerofothers.com. I first met Leo, it was via an email that I sent him. It was a cold email. He didn't have any clue who I was or what I was. I had read his first book that he co-authored with Leon Shapiro, who at the time was the CEO of Vistage. And the title of the book was The Power of Peers. And I wanted to see if Leo had any interest in starting a podcast, because I found big value in the ideas that he put forth in that first book. And I wondered if a podcast might help get the word out that there was this tremendous power in helping other people and in allowing other people to help us. I did a series of audio summaries of that first book, The Power of Others, and I did it right here on this podcast. You can go back and check those out. I'm going to put links in the show notes for today's episode. Just go to the website, thepowerofothers.com. Just look for season 2020, episode 31. I'm going to give you the entire list of those episodes. And I'm also going to put a link to the very first interview that I did with Leo here on this program. It was after I summarized all 11 chapters of that first book. And one thing led to another, and we did launch a podcast, by the way, called The Year of the Peer. Today, it is called Peernovation, just like the title of Leo's third book. And we're going to talk to Leo coming up next. Okay,
as Matt Damon said in Good Will Hunting, let the healing begin. When he was going to sit down with Robin Williams, that was an awesome line.
Yeah, it was.
I'm pumped. Yeah. Let the healing begin. I'm pumped.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, the audience knows you, Leo, because they know that we do some stuff together with your podcast, our podcast at Peernovation.co. And I'll have to go back and look, but I did a chapter by chapter, kind of an audio summary of The Power of Peers, you may recall. And when I got through with that, I had you on the show. So that was the first introduction that my audience had to you. And I'll put links to all that in the show notes. But I'm excited for what brings us together today. And that's book number three, Peernovation, the same name as this title of this podcast. And I'm going to throw you a curveball, because you're a guy from Boston, and people like me from this part of the country, I'm pretty fascinated with how people grew up, especially people that didn't grow up in this kind of Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana area where I'm from. So I don't know. I'd like to hear about how you grew up.
Sure. So I grew up in a little peninsula called Howe's Neck. And it's part of the city of Quincy, which borders Boston to the south. And the interesting thing about Howe's Neck when I grew up is there was a lot of these homes that were little summer cottages that had basically been converted into year-round residences for people. So we literally had this house that my dad bought for, I want to say, it was either $11,000 or $12,000 back then. He said, I think he made the down payment with $500 on a credit card. And that's how you were able to do things back then. But there was this 9-room house that literally sits on the water, that had a Boston skyline in the background. So for me, that idea of living in this, small peninsula, which is a very cool neighborhood, your basic kids getting together, playing seasonal sports as you do in New England, where, one minute, baseball season's over and it's time to play football now. And it's like, and if you played baseball one day past when football started, you're like, what's wrong with you? You're like an idiot, you know? So sports was always a huge thing. Not only the seasonal aspect of it, but we were blessed with some great sports teams and great towns, and Boston's an incredible sports city, but it's also a city that, back then, I remember looking at, there were like 70 some odd 2 and 4 year institutions of higher education in the greater Boston area. There's great art museums, a wonderful symphony. There's, so much in terms of culture and all of that, that, you know, I was always drawn to those things, and it was always very aspirational for me. We all wanted to grow up and, you know, play in the Red Sox, but we also kind of got an appreciation for just a lot of different things, and certainly gave me an impetus for wanting to further my formal education. And it was kind of the ticket, I'm not saying out of that neighborhood, that would be the wrong way to characterize it. But the reality was, in the neighborhood that I worked in, you know, people were pretty much in, you know, they were policemen or firemen or nurses or, you know, all wonderful, respectable jobs. But there was nobody, for example, there were no CEOs in my neighborhood. There were no, business people. There was like that whole world was completely foreign to anything, I grew up in. So, over time, I thought it was a good start. But then, since growing up in Boston, when I was in my 20s, I went to college in Florida, lived there for a long time. I had a second place in Colorado, lived there. Now I live in Southern California. I've been lucky to travel, although I never left the country until I was 40. But since then, I've really tried to make travel a part of things, because it's how we learn. It's how we broaden our perspectives on a lot of things. And so, yeah, so it was kind of this, on one hand, like all of us, you know, we grow up with just in pretty narrow surroundings in the scheme of things. And then it's up to us to kind of figure out, you know, how we broaden those horizons. I don't care if you grow up in Boston or Oklahoma or in Anchorage, Alaska, you know, it's we're all, I think, challenged in the same way.
I'm interested in that kind of stuff because I had a project when I was in junior high. You know, we were asked, okay, what do you want to do? And now go find somebody who's doing what you want to do and interview them for this school project. And at the time I was really into art. Primarily I was into cartooning. And if you would have asked the junior high version of me, I would have said, oh, I want to be a cartoonist. And I'm still very much into cartoons, and not panels, but just single, just a single.
Yeah. And you share some beautiful cartoons on social media all the time. Yeah.
So it goes back to childhood. Right. And so I remember telling the teacher, I don't know anybody that does, Charles Schulz. I mean, you knew Peanuts, but I don't know these people. I don't know who these people live. And I had somewhat of a fascination with words and thought, writers. But for me, all the writers lived up like where you were. All the writers were from New England. I didn't know anybody from Oklahoma or Texas or Louisiana that wrote.
But Emerson. Emerson and Thoreau and all those guys have been dead for a while, though,
Yeah, exactly. But I found the cartoonist for the newspaper, and I went and interviewed him. And ironically, he had gone to art school with Charles Schulz, who had come up with Peanuts. And I remember, he's telling me he wasn't the best student, right? I mean, he wasn't even the best artist, but not by a long shot in the class, but he really understood people. And, and I was 11, 12, something like that, when I interviewed this guy. But it's always stuck with me. But that frame of reference is always interesting to me, because how we grow up, I don't know. I think it impacts our, what we think is possible, maybe. And to your point, a lot of our work together with this whole notion of peers is for us to expand all of that, and to realize that way more is possible than maybe we think. So that's the reason for the question.
Totally. And all of it makes me think of two things. One is that, first of all, if someone were to ask me back then, what do you think you want to be, and interview someone who did it, my lens on what the possible jobs were back then was so small. You know, it's almost like, remember when we had Tina Martini on our program?
Yeah.
And I said, oh, when you were five, did you want to be an intellectual properties attorney? Right. Of course. You know, what is that? Right. You know, at what point in your life do you discover that's even possible? And then all of a sudden you make your life's work. But the other thing was, and this goes back to your cartoonist example, I was hugely interested in photography, so much to the point where I really started investing and spending a lot of time in it to be told, what are you doing? You're never going to get a job doing that. Okay. Then one of my early jobs, I'm at working at an ad agency, watching people being paid a gajillion dollars for every photograph that ever, you know, appeared in a print ad or something. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. Right. It appears, you know, maybe there is some money to be made in this field where people are, you know, work on that craft if they want to. And if they're good enough at it, they can do pretty well. So,
yeah, well, I got told the same thing about art, you know. And of course, I got shoved like everybody did toward the commercial side of it, which, to your point, is the, right. is the advertising side of things.
Yeah.
I've since learned how the economy works, you know, once we got old enough. What book had a big impact on you?
I guess
I know you're a voracious reader, as am I, but I know it's maybe a tough question. But
so if I were to say from a business leadership standpoint now, and I read it back in 2006 for the first time, and of course re-looked at it and read the other books as well. But I think The Leadership Challenge by Jim Kouzes and Barry Posner is about as good as it gets. And it isn't just about, you know, the five exemplary practices of leadership and some of the kind of obvious lessons that are there. But I think the more you dig deeper into the book, the more you can embrace it, not as something about what you do, but who you are and who you can become as a leader. And I think what I liked about it on one hand was it kind of codified what I hoped was possible, right? Because I'm sure, and I think we've talked about this, we have shared experiences when it comes to like the tyrannical leaders, you know, the command and control, right. You know. Nobody got praised if they did anything well. You just get screamed at if you know, something didn't go well. And it was just all that dynamic. The, you know, what Dave Logan talks about is, I'm great, you're not, you know, type of leadership style. And, you know, I always thought to myself, God, there's got to be a better way to do this. There's got to be a better way for people like me and others to feel better about going to work than to feel like you're just going to get your ass kicked every day. So,
where did that come from, do you think? I mean, in you. Because, see, I was always wired the same way. I was always plagued by the question, there's got to be a better way. Surely there's a better way. I had no idea. I mean, as a young person.
Oh, no. And nor did I ever see anybody exhibit those behaviors.
Yeah, no, me neither. You wonder where that comes from?
So I think about things like that. I think about the fact that when I was growing up, I never thought I would stay in the community I grew up in. There was just something, and again, I don't make this as a value judgment or something that's better or not or whatever, but for me, I was like, I am supposed to do something else. I'm supposed to do something different. And where does that come from? I have no clue. I don't know what that's all about. I didn't know what it was. I didn't have any idea about it. So, and maybe that fuels a lot of, you know, I was interested in a lot of things as a kid. I'm interested in a lot of things now. I'm still trying to, you talk about, you know, reading, you talk about, I'm going through this certification program right now at Squircle, which is a whole brand new assessment thing that I'm just excited to learn about and try to integrate it into, you know, what I'm doing right now. And so, I don't know where it comes from, you know, but
yeah, me too. Thankful for
grateful for it.
Yeah, thankful that we've got the curiosity or whatever it is. All right, let's get down to brass tacks. So what problem are you most trying to solve, not just with this book, but even on a broader level with your work today?
So if you really go on a broader level, you got to look at our culture right now and the divisiveness. And it's not just the political front. We've gotten to a place as a people where we don't talk to one another very easily. We don't listen for understanding. We are very much about judging, very much about debating and winning and being right and all this other stuff is at the expense of really trying to learn from the experiences of other people and understand their gifts versus being critical of why they're different from us. So I think when you think about that larger context that we operate in, now it's all of a sudden we have to go into workplaces where we're expected to now we're going to collaborate, we'll cooperate, and it's all kumbaya and we're all going to do this together. And in many cases, a lot of us haven't really built the skills or the muscles or the understanding of how to go about doing that really well. It's why I get fascinated with learning teams. When I was at Seton Hall University, back in 2006, 2008 in my master's program, where instead of this relationship that seemed to be one-to-one with the teacher, where I just submitted quizzes or papers and that was that, you had a team of students who learned from one another. And then to go to Vistage and watch how CEOs did that for one another and what that looked like. Now you start seeing, okay, this is really possible and this works really well. People in the right circumstances can be vulnerable. They can admit when they don't know something, when they're scared of something, when, they're just, whatever may be going on in their life that may be keeping them from getting to where they need to be, that they can share that and there's value and power in doing that. For teams, when I look at teams and companies, and I think about, you asked about what business problems are we trying to solve for? Well, there's a few of them. One of them is strategic alignment, right? So we have this big strategic initiative we want to do at the company, but getting people truly aligned and making that possible so that you could not fall and become the statistic of the 65 to 90% of teams that fail with strategic initiatives, depending on what the research you're looking at, it's pretty important. But you need a mechanism to be able to bring people together to do that. And that's why I think companies need to have groups as well as teams. Teams, of course, are working on the collective work product. Groups are working to make the individuals that much better so they can be stronger contributors and that together they can achieve some sense of alignment about what things they enjoy doing and what to actually implement and how to go about making that possible. So I think strategic alignment is one. Accountability is another. When everyone feels they're all part of the same team, when the leader is a part of the team and not apart from it, you can develop a culture of accountability that feels much more like people accepting personal responsibility for how much they matter and just bringing their A game to work all the time and having that expectation publicly for each other, recognizing their currency rests there, with everyone else. And that can be extremely powerful and certainly much better than the model of the leader and the employee feels like they're playing defense all the time. That can be troubling. There's the diversity and inclusion, which obviously has become a big thing. Think about the last year and how much we all recognize how much we have to learn, from others about what their experiences are and what that looks like. And I think in the workplace, it's a great place to start. We've had a lot of initiatives around diversity, and that's fine, but we just haven't been very good at the inclusion part because we're not always really good, again, about listening for understanding and really trying to, have that level of, connection with people in that regard. So, those are certainly, some big ones for sure.
I'm blessed in my coaching practice in that I don't do remedial work. It's not because of any marketing genius on my part. It just tends to be the way things work. People don't typically invest in quote unquote executive or leadership coaching unless they're already performing at a high level, I have found. So it's just one of those things that very organically it just happened. And yet you think of all the people that could benefit from such an exercise, and you think about your work and the work that we're trying to do together over at the podcast and even other than that with Peernovation. I mean, what are your thoughts about that of, the people that may need some of this stuff the most, may not even be looking for it. And I get that more exposure, more visibility, and more access, and which I know is a big thing for you, especially with this book.
Well, it leads to kind of a fourth business problem you're trying to solve for, is even if you do have access to it, you can be working for a company that actually places a premium on that. They have great content and great trainers and great programs, and they have micro learning, and they have day-long training sessions. They have all this kind of stuff. The problem is that there's no mechanism to be able to actually absorb that, take it in, you know, for yourself or with teammates, and actually operationalize it. You know, we are usually working in companies today, and it doesn't matter if you're remote or, you know, you're back in the office right now, but you're likely in a situation where you're part of a smaller team that's asked to do more work more quickly than ever before, which means that anytime you take time to train, what happens? When you get back, you've got 1,000 emails waiting for you, you've got whatever, and you get sucked back into that. And all of those great ideas that days earlier were so amazing to you, they just get, you know, lost in the ether. And so this is where groups, I think, can have an incredible impact. And, you know, when you look at how really great groups are run, and it would be great to bring those in to the organization, not only to serve it as a mechanism to deal with those four issues we talk about, but they're going to make your teams that much better. Because everything that groups do, if you can bring some of those same practices into your team environment, it's like Katie bar the door. I mean, you know, you're going to do some amazing things. And, you know, it's this progression of recognizing that we've been influenced by our peers for as long as we can remember. We get that. You know, in the first book, The Power of Peers, this idea of peer advantage was simply being more selective, strategic, and structured about the people that you surround yourself with. And when you do that, you can do some really special things, right? Peer innovation becomes the outcome of that. So when you surround yourself with those people, now all of a sudden you can create work together that's truly larger than yourself. And, you know, it's a sight to see when you see teams really working together, you know, having that incredible work relationship, have experienced that flow, you know, together. It's really powerful.
I talk quite a bit. My audience hears me talk about, you know, anticipation of the ideal outcome. The notion's not profound. It's just, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing well. Why would you want to embark on something and not do it well? With this book and this relatively new company, Peernovation, what's the ideal outcome that you would like to achieve? And let me throw it at you from two perspectives. One is next, you know, the very next ideal outcome. And then on a bigger, broader, more audacious picture, what would that look like?
So I would say this, when I think about content like this, some people will read it and they will, you know, feel like, okay, you know, great. And they've read it and they get it and they put it down, like we do with a lot of books we get. Other people will read it and go, wow, this to me connects with me and connects with what me and my organization want to do in a way that I've never quite seen before. And just in terms of the framing of it. And I think there's value to that. I mean, whether you're looking at, you know, Lencioni's Five Dysfunctions of a Team, or you're looking at all kinds of things out there with regard to team and team buildings and what works and what doesn't and all that, it isn't an issue of one better than the other or how they're different or whatever. It's much more about what can you connect with in a way that makes it feel like something you would actually do and you would take action on. So my hope is that a lot of people read this book and feel like this speaks to me, like I get this. You know, I've had, you know, in addition to reviews and things like that, but obviously before the book ever came out, just to have people I really trust be able to look at this and who, by the way, would, you know, excuse me, wouldn't be bashful about telling me that it sucked or that it didn't right. make any sense or anything. They would do it in exactly those terms, all from their heart, though, by the way, because they care. But the reality is that to have them come back one after another and say, this case is not only strong, but it's made with a level of clarity that they believe could make a real difference for people, that people will read it and they'll get it. and be willing to actually share it with others, which is one of the reasons when we think about, so what's the ultimate outcome? I want to put this content in the hands of as many people as possible in the hope that it connects with, you know, more than not, and who would be willing to operationalize it and make it work for them and make it work for their organizations. And so I think there are some time-honored principles from peer advisory groups that I think this narrative codifies and advances and even translates into a teamwork environment that that I think is pretty powerful, you know, and I'm happy about that aspect of it. And I just want this in as many hands as can get it, which is why I literally priced the ebook at $3.99. If I have a soft cover version right out of the gate, not waiting or anything like that, at $12.99. You know, you get your hard cover at $30 or whatever is fine. And it's, you know, great, you know, it's nice and all of that. But I think in the end, I wanted it to be something that a leader would look at and say, okay, I want to get a bunch of these for my team, but I don't want it to be astronomical for them to be able to do that. I want to be able to afford, like, boom, it's super easy. You don't even have to think about it. It's so little to do it. So, we just keep extending the reach of this thing. And, you know, I'm excited. You know, there's already interest in translating into Chinese working on a, you know, a proposal that's come to me about that. The Power of Peers was both in English, Chinese, and in Spanish. And so we'll look for an avenue on that as well. And there's some interest in Portuguese and the and Dutch also. So again, the more we can kind of extend this, the better.
Yeah. Last question. And I'll put links in the show notes for Amazon links and all that, not affiliate links, just you can go to Amazon. It's Peernovation is the title of the book. And yeah, we strongly, you know, we want to get as many reviews and as many people to read the book and hopefully, to your point, put it into action. Last question, share a story of somebody who made a major contribution to your life. And it doesn't matter what area, just one powerful illustration of the power of others, you know, to kind of take off on the title of this show, The Power of Other People. You've been a person who's impacted me in a pretty powerful way over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years or so. And I've talked about that to the audience. I mean, none of us are an island, but I'm gonna, is there a story that leaps to your mind that you want to share?
Yeah. And it was a story I actually shared in What Anyone Can Do about my dad. You know, right now I'm in a completely different career, if you think about it, from what I spent most of my life doing in corporate communications and brand and all of that. And I think a lot of that was inspired by my dad in his early 40s when he left the Boston Police Department and was going to take a job in the insurance business. He had won a pro-am with some guy with the pro, and he was the amateur that day, and they were going out to dinner that night. And my dad's telling him what he's going to do. And he said, what are you doing that for? He said, why don't you go in the golf business? He said, and go through the schools and be a Class A PGA professional and teach golf. It's what you love to do. It's what you, my dad is like, well, you know, that's what 20-year-olds do. You know, they go to those schools and all that. And he says, so what? There's no law to say that you couldn't do it. And by the way, if you do, and it'll be 3 years or so, and then you'll be done with it. And then you can teach golf for the rest of your life. And it's like, huh, you know, so he did it. And he taught golf for 35 years or so. And then he's been retired, but now looks like next season coming up, they opened up a brand new range at his golf club, and he lives near there. So they said, hey, we'd like you to come teach a couple of days a week. My dad's like, great, you know? And so to be able to get the lesson that if you want to do something and if you have a passion around it, don't ever feel that it's passed you by. And I've given advice to friends with that. I had a guy one time, and he was only like 30 at the time. And he says to me, you know, God, I wish I, you know, had learned how to play the piano. And I said, well, your fingers aren't broken, right? I mean, you know, what would stop you from learning that? And it just never really occurred to him. So now he's been playing piano for 20 years. You know, I mean, it's just how that goes. So I think that's a pretty, you know, profound lesson, especially now as, you know, we're living longer, living healthier, living in ways that, you know, we get, I'm in my early 60s and I feel as good as I ever have in my whole life, physically, you know, and in every other aspect of things. And so I think we all have a lot to contribute. And as long as we don't ever for a minute think that something that we really want to do has passed us by, then I think that's a good thing.
It's a good place to end. Thanks for being on the show. I appreciate you. I appreciate the friendship. Really appreciate the book. And I told Leo before, you know, while he was in the throes of writing the book, I just, you know, and I'm an intuitive guy, and Leo is too, that, yeah, I mean, my intuition is telling me we're at kind of this, I don't know, we're at a pivotal moment here, you know, with this work and with this message and the evangelizing that we're trying to do with this whole notion of kind of lifting each other up and helping each other out, certainly is needed in today's world. So thanks for being on the show.
Anytime, and I appreciate you as well. See you soon.
Thanks. Well, I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Days ago, the book was released, Peer Innovation, What Peer Advisory Groups Can Teach Us About Building High-Performing Teams. And Leo has intentionally priced this book for the widest possible audience. And we both hope that you will invest in a copy. Better yet, we hope you'll employ the framework that Leo has designed to help you become part of or to become a leader of a higher performing team. And so I hope you enjoyed the conversation as we kind of talked about Leo's childhood growing up in Boston to that fantastic story that he ended with about his father's late life success in this brand new career. You can visit Leo's website. You can find it at LeoBottary.com. That's LeoBottary.com. I'm going to encourage you, I'll put a link in the show notes to his Twitter account. Tweet Leo if you enjoyed today's show. That's one thing that you can do to kind of help us out. Today's show was brought to you by The Peer Advantage. You can get all the details by going to ThePeerAdvantage.com. Be well, do good, grow great. My name is Randy Cantrell. Greetings and welcome inside the Yellow Studio.